funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. The American general, George S. Patton, once said, "Compared to war, all other forms of human endeavor shrink to insignificance." So it's surprising to find there's been no survey of war photography as vast, as comprehensive as our guest's book. It's called War/Photography. With 480 images and half a dozen contributing authors, it's a huge endeavor. It took Ann Wilkes Tucker and her team 10 years to compile. Tucker is the senior curator of photography at the Museum of Fine Arts, Houston. She's written or contributed to at least a dozen books, including a history of Japanese photography and a study of the great French photographer Brassai. Ann Wilkes Tucker will be speaking at Collin County Community College next month, October 20th in Plano. Ann, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Pat Barker is a very fine English novelist. She's written a whole series of novels on World War I, and in one of them, Life Class, it's based on real-life painters in World War I, British painters, and they struggle because this is a period of tremendous ferment in painting with cubism and abstraction and all this, and yet they found this incredible resistance from the British Ministry of War. They could not depict corpses. They could not depict real life in the trenches, for instance. And I remember in reading that book a couple of years ago, I thought, boy, photography blew all that out of the water. And yet in reading your book, particularly in the essays by John Stauffer and Natalie Zelt, it turns out that what we think of photography, this kind of revolution, was sort of a slow-moving one. And I was wondering if you could talk about the differences that occurred with the Crimean War, the Civil War, World War I, how photography changed.
Photography, when it was invented, involved large cameras, tripods, slow negative materials. So the early portrait Mexican-American War were all portraits where the people were stationary. Then came the Crimean War, where Roger Fenton made an extraordinary series of photographs. But again, he's using a tripod and a camera. And at one point when he was photographing a battlefield after the battle, because he couldn't photograph action, he still had to suddenly move his camera because the opposition saw him and saw his photographic van and thought he was something they should shoot shells at. And then came the Civil War, which was really the first fully covered, many photographers, both working for the military and commercially for Matthew Brady, everyone knows. But again, you're photographing the aftermath of war. No one could photograph the action. By the Boer War was the first war with the film camera, the snapshot camera, and actually the submachine gun. But both the Boer War and World War I, even though they had the capability, there was such censorship. The camera was still very new. The military was very nervous. And you had to be in the army, in one of the services, in order to carry a camera. And what you could distribute was heavily regulated. And even today, they don't want you showing the dead of your own military. You can show as many dead as you want of the enemy. But even today, there's a reluctance, and the Bush administration didn't want you to even show the caskets coming home. So it's a complex story, which we tried to tell.
It's partly, it wasn't simply matters of kind of military or political censorship. It was also cases of standards of taste. In the book, Roger Fenton actually witnessed corpses on the ground, for instance, but he didn't take any photos of them at all. Whereas in the Civil War, it became something of a I don't want to say popular fad, but the photographs of the dead became a very big deal.
Well, remember, Roger Fenton was told by none other than Prince Albert that he should remain an English gentleman in the photographs that he made. And he had been sent to the Crimean because Florence Nightingale had written about the horrible conditions there. And so he was a bit of a propagandist supporting that the British were, in fact, taking care of their wounded. The Civil War, the largest photographing was done for commercial interest. Matthew Brady had a studio in Washington, so he was relatively close to much of the action, and sent his photographers that worked for him out, many of whom became famous in their own right. The Southern cause was not nearly as well recorded because there was not this entrepreneurial spirit that occurred to cover the Southern side as well as the Northern side.
There's, I think, when people think back on photos related to war, very profound images, there is a sense that photos could trigger a war. For instance, there's the famous shot of the masts of the USS Maine blown up in Havana. And it was publicized, used as a kind of rallying cry. And naturally, there are all the images we have of 9/11. And there's an idea, as you indicate, amongst war photographers, journalists, that the photography could stop a war, that if people really saw this. But Susan Sontag, the great critic, felt that this was an illusion. This really didn't happen, that were larger forces that really start or stop wars. I was wondering if you talk about that. What is photography's force, its effect?
Photography has had, photographs, specific photographs, have had profound effects on public attitudes, private attitudes, individual actions. Yes, the sinking of the Maine, the photographs of the mast of the Maine sticking up in the water of Havana Harbor was carried by Hearst newspapers and promoted and was certainly part of raising American receptivity to our eventual going into what became the Spanish-American War. The sight of the battleships in Pearl Harbor was very powerful, but we did not publish it at the time. In fact, we completely downplayed the number of dead who were killed in that attack. 9/11 was, of course, something that those photographs were immediate. One of the photographers who took the photographs, the sequence of the second plane going into the towers, he took those from his roof in Brooklyn. All transportation had immediately been shut down in New York, so he had to walk from Brooklyn to the Time Life building on 42nd Street in Manhattan. But Time comes out on a Monday morning. By Thursday morning, they had a new issue of Time out with the photographs. And, of course, television had been showing those images. During Vietnam, the photographs of the monk who immolated himself, of Kim Puck running down the road burned by Agent Orange, and Eddie Adams' famous photograph of the general executing a Viet Cong had tremendous impact on public sympathy for the American war effort. Has a photograph ever stopped war, and will it? No. As much as photographers are willing to risk their lives in hopes that that will happen, wars are generated by greed and anger and vengeance and so many other human emotions that are not necessarily susceptible to the kind of empathy that a photograph can generate. But they are powerful propaganda, and that's why photographs are so tightly controlled by most major nations and used by both sides.
In flipping through this book, people will see many familiar images, and they're often by professional war correspondents. But you opened up this whole range to amateur family snapshots kinds of things. I wonder if you could talk about what led to that decision. This is a much broader range than I think people would normally expect.
One of the reasons we started this research 10 years before the show opened was we felt that the discussion about war photography had become locked into certain, and academically they're called tropes of thinking, largely those built up around Susan Sontag's opinions. And while I have huge respect for Ms. Sontag, the second and third generation of people who are interpreting what she said didn't always seem to me to hold. And we just wanted to break open the discussion. And part of the way of doing that was showing the enormous number of images that had never really been studied by the public or academia in snapshots or even in military photographers, in photographs. Many more photographers in war that are military photographers than there are photojournalists. And so we wanted to show, and the portrait, people don't usually think of portraits as wartime photographs, but in fact it's the most common genre because every soldier is photographed on coming into an established army, and every commercial photographer knows that photographers want to have their pictures taken before they go off to war. So we just wanted to open up the discussion of what we're really talking about when the words war photography are used, because most people do tend to think of Joe Rosenthal's picture on Iwo Jima or Eddie Adams' picture in Vietnam or Brady's photographs of the Civil War. And those pictures have been taken out of context, and we just thought the context was really important. And that's why we discuss the tactics of war as much as we discuss the phenomena of taking pictures.
And you discuss all these amazing sort of ancillary things that I would not have normally expected. So you get a great deal of a kind of homey quality at times, sort of the home front. I looked through the book and I could not find, did you ever run a cell phone picture?
We have, yes. They're in the very beginning. They are by Michael Brown, and they are photographs of Libya. They are the first cell phone photographs run by National Geographic. And Michael, on the second day that he was in Libya, his finer cameras were smashed. And yet he was there on assignment, and so all he could work with was his cell phone, and that's what he did. He used it and submitted the photographs, and they were published in National Geographic. That's going to happen more and more as the quality of cell phone, just the higher and higher level of bytes is available through cell phone. But yeah, we did get them in the very last group, and actually, one of the snapshots by a military photographer, the man cutting grass in Iraq, he planted a little tiny little bed of grass outside his tent in Iraq, and that was photographed by another soldier. And that was also, I don't know if it was cell phone, but it was a digital photograph.
You mentioned Joe Rosenthal earlier, and we'll probably have to take this after the break. And I understand that this the exhibition in the book was prompted by your museum receiving a copy of the Joe Rosenthal famous Iwo Jima photo. And I was wondering why you devoted an entire chapter to it. We'll take this after the break.
Great.
You've been listening to Ann Wilkes Tucker, my guest, the author of a major book on war/photography. And we'll be returning right after the break to continue our discussion.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. In this hour, we're talking to Ann Wilkes Tucker, curator of photography at the Museum of Fine Arts, Houston. We're talking about her remarkable epic book, War/Photography. If you wish to join in the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. You can also see a slideshow of images from the book at keranews.org. Nan, before the break, I was asking you about the Joe Rosenthal photo, the flag raising on Iwo Jima, probably the single most famous image in American war photography. And I understand that the exhibition that started this book and was prompted by the acquisition of a copy of Rosenthal's photo by the museum, and that the book itself devotes an entire chapter to just that single image. And I was wondering why.
Okay, let me first address acquiring it. In 2002, we acquired what is fairly reliably thought to be the first print made from that negative. All of the photographs in the Pacific were gathered. The negatives were gathered from press photographers, from military photographers, everyone, and they were flown to a large lab in Guam where they were developed. And then the censors approved or disapproved, and then they were distributed to the press. Rosenthal was an AP photographer. The man who developed the negative saw what an extraordinary image that was and made a print and sent it home to his family. And so that's before Rosenthal even saw the image himself, before it was published on the front page of thousands of American newspapers. It was taken on a Friday, developed on a Saturday, and printed on a Sunday at a time when, this is February 1945, when America really needed good news. The Pacific was going better, but still the loss of life was enormous. And that photograph, because Iwo Jima was the first land, Japanese land, so the American flag being raised on Japanese land meant the world to the American public and the families of the servicemen when it was published. So as the exhibition evolved, the structure of the exhibition is that rather than doing a chronological exhibition, we chose themes of how, what kinds of photographs were made in every conflict, and that they're organized in the order of war, starting with joining up, being trained, embarking, going through the fight, aftermath, et cetera, et cetera. We felt there needed to be at least one battle where it shows all of those, except, of course, embarkation and joining up, happening in one, relative to one battle. So it shows the invasion of Iwo Jima, which was horrendous. Rosenthal said to land on that beach and not be hit by a bullet was equivalent to walking in the rain and not getting wet. The Japanese knew there was only one beach that they could land on. They had a brilliant general in charge of the defense of the island, and they had trained all their guns on the beach. They let the first and then the second wave land before they started the barrage, and the cost was horrific. Then they inch by inch by inch won the island. The Mount Suribachi, where that flag was raised, is right near the beach. And so when the Marines had gained the first airfield and taken Mount Suribachi, the American generals wanted the men still fighting, it's going to be another 3 weeks before they fully take Iwo Jima, to know that we'd gain Mount Suribachi. So they raised the flag. It was a small traditional flag. It wasn't big enough. He sent back out to get a ship flag, which is larger, which is the photograph Rosenthal made. And soldiers stopped and cheered, and ships tooted their whistles, and it was a huge moment for the men who were fighting on Iwo Jima. Then we covered the death and the medicine and all the other aspects that were broken into sections in the rest of the show.
And in that chapter, you also show kind of what happened to Rosenthal's photo, its transformation into an icon. There's even a photo of a Texas parade, I believe a high school parade, where they're reenacting the flag raising.
Oh. We had a GI doll that had the photographs. We had the parade photograph. There's a giant woodcut somewhere in Washington that was photographed. We did not put the milk bottle in. We did not put the replica of the flag raising, the statue of the flag raising that Ross Perot has in his office and posed next to when he was running for president. We did not put the photograph of the replica that is at Arlington Cemetery in Washington. I mean, we could have done a whole exhibition of the replicas and the promotion of that image. It's still one that means a great deal to many people.
I first encountered your book several months ago in a bookstore and was immediately drawn to it because of the cover image, a black and white photograph of soldiers on the Russian front in World War II. It's a very striking image. And then, of course, just by the sheer size of the book, I started flipping through it. And I have to confess, one of my immediate thoughts was people normally refer to a book like this as a coffee table book. Publishers often call them gift books. And I mean, my immediate thought was, this is a tremendous volume. I wonder who the audience is. Did you wonder about that when you were making this? I mean, there are chapters.
Sure.
There are three chapters in a row. Civilian grief, children, and refugees. That will break your heart. I mean, they're hard to get through. And so it's not your usual sort of gift book in that sense. They're very, very powerful. But it is a grim topic.
It's not a bestseller, but it's sold 6,000 copies so far. So that's,
for an expensive book.
Respectable. And what delights us is that the people buying them are the general public, they're colleges and universities, they are military colleges and universities and schools. One of the things that meant the most to us is some therapists have let us know that they are using the book in dealing with PTSD, that returning veterans have found that while they may not be able to speak about their own experiences, they can look through the book and they can say, "Well, we didn't do it that way. We did da 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 da," and talk about it. One veteran told me that he liked the book because it put what they did in a tapestry that he could understand. So that's all very meaningful to us. It's finding its audience, but that's the beauty of books. I mean, the beauty of books is that people are going to find them in libraries and they're going to pull them down and they're going to do some other research. And we've had people tell us they joined a military service because of the show. We've had people tell us they decided not to join a military service because of a show. People's reaction to it are hugely varied, and that's healthy and what we're delighted about.
There, I would argue there are two most moving, most powerful images that have come out of the Iraq War. One is the photograph of the badly burned, badly deformed Marine in his dress uniform on his wedding day. And you have that photo in the book. The other photo, though, is of the hooded Iraqi prisoner at Abu Ghraib who was being tortured. You don't have that photo, but you have two representations of that image, one of a soldier watching it on television, another one of a graffiti on a wall. And I was wondering what led to that decision.
That photograph never existed as a print. It was always viral. It was always a television and computer image. So we decided to represent it in the way that it went viral. So one image is a Marine in Iraq sitting watching President Bush's apology with that image on a television screen. And the other one is where that has been painted on a wall on a children's playground. So to some extent, that image became like Rosenthal's flag. I mean, it became an image that embodied a lot of feeling and was widely reproduced in the Arab world. One of the people we interviewed said that he was a surgeon in Iraq. He was in the mess hall when the news broke, when the television news broke. They were right down from Abu Ghraib. They didn't know. He said this entire mess hall of 400 servicemen went silent because they knew what that image was going to mean to them in what they were doing in Iraq. And so we just wanted to acknowledge that viral aspect, the television, you know, rather than just putting the print on the wall.
I understand that the process of creating this, you did not go out searching for this, that you went out sifting through thousands of images and archives all over the world and slowly created your themes. And I was wondering if you could talk about that, because there are, in hindsight, there are things, chapters like faith, that I would not initially have thought of. But in hindsight, they make perfect sense to be included in the book.
We let the images tell us the story. My colleague Will Michaels and Natalie Zelt, we would go to archives. We'd sit there all day. We'd look at hundreds of images split up. And then at dinner that night, without notes, we would ask each other what images remained in our mind, what images out of all the hundreds we'd looked at still spoke to us. And we made lists. We got reproductions. We'd come back to the museum and we'd put those up on a big board and we would look at them and we would sort them, and then they began to fall into categories. At this point, various military historians, Jeff Hunt at the Military Museum in Austin at Camp Mayberry was an enormous aid, Hillary Roberts at the Imperial War Museum in Britain, and various other military historians and veterans would say to us, oh, that's a silly category, get rid of that, or where's this, or you don't have enough Navy. And that was really helpful because it gave, none of us have ever served in the military, so it really helped us keep the perspective of that side of the experience, and they really helped us shape it. Relative to faith, Constantine was the first general to have chaplains in his forces. And so it's a long, long tradition to combine the religious. And in the exhibition, we did represent Jewish and Muslim and Christian components. One of the photographs I love is a chaplain in Venezuela who risked his life to go out and give last rites to a soldier who'd been shot in an open street war.
You cover all these different aspects that one normally wouldn't have thought of in terms of a book on war photography. As we've said, medicine, memorials, children. There is no chapter on women, though. You do have female combatants in images, but there's no chapter devoted to them.
Good point. And it was thought about, but I remember when in the 70s, I was reading a book on artists, and I read the whole book, and then I came to the last chapter was on women artists. And I said, wait a minute, all these other things that were said don't apply to women artists? I mean, we need a separate chapter. And I just felt that women are making their way in the military, and so we would treat them equally and put them into the show, but in the show as serving in various ranks and services. One of the moving moments for me was going through the exhibition with a returning woman veteran from Iraq, and there were rooms she couldn't go into, and there were other rooms that she went into, and she started talking to me about her experiences. And, you know, it was a very moving experience for me, and I hope for her. But we wanted to just show people, and we got as many photographs as we could of women in service into the show.
You mentioned in your introduction that you included photos that might be considered disputed, I suppose. And I was struck particularly about the famous Robert Capa photo of a Spanish loyalist being shot. And there's been a great deal of investigation of whether that photo really was really happened or was staged. What was the idea for including that kind of photo?
Well, the two photographs, Roger Fenton's photograph of cannonballs in Crimea and Robert Capa's photograph of the loyalists being shot, that are too embedded in the imagination of anybody who's ever looked at conflict photography to exclude. We just thought they're part of our imagination. They're part of the discussion. The best thing was to do is to bring them in, acknowledge the discussion around both photographs. In fact, in the book, we have two authors disagreeing about the Fenton, vehemently saying it's this way or it's that way. But also, with the Capa, there's so few photographs of the moment when somebody is injured or, even rarer, killed. Sadly for us, there's a Tony Vaccaro photograph that we discovered after we'd done the show. But there are executions, and we have a section on executions, but that's one of the two rarest pictures are the advent of war and the moment in which a serviceman is killed other than an execution. And so that's why that photograph has been so important. And I've read all the controversy, and I don't think we'll ever know the answer, no matter how authoritarian people are, because the negatives are lost, and it's so critical to know the order in which they were shot, and without the negatives, we won't know that. So I don't think that answer is forthcoming unless the negatives are found.
My guest is Ann Wilkes Tucker, and we're discussing war photography, and we'll be right back after this break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. And we're talking this hour with Ann Wilkes Tucker about her book, War/Photography. If you wish to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. You can also go to keranews.org to see a slideshow of images from the book, War/Photography. We were talking earlier about some of the topics that you cover, and we mentioned the Abu Ghraib prisoner, and there's a whole chapter, of course, on interrogation. And I wonder if other people feel the same in viewing such images, images of interrogation, of brutality, of violent death. And one of the reasons I think people instinctively want to avoid or turn away from, and not simply that they're very affecting, but there's a sense that you're complicit just in viewing these things. And I know war photographers often have that response after being on the front lines a long time, that they are somehow complicit in this.
The answer is, that's a complicated but very good question. And the complicity is there. And on the other side of the scale is, if you don't take the pictures, no one knows. I've had very angry people stand in lectures, and we've discussed this. And my response is, so there are no photographs of the Holocaust, so there are no photographs of the people in Sierra Leone and the Congo. David Taylor chopped off their arms and their legs and their hands. Those photographs were used in his war crimes in The Hague. I think the photographers feel very conflicted, and most of the time they feel the need to document history prevails. The one exception was in all the millions of photographs we looked at, we never saw a photograph of rape. And rape is a tool of war, sometimes actually commanded by the upper of soldiers. We found a dead woman who had clearly been raped, a snapshot of her in a German soldier snapshot album. But photographers who had witnessed rape, especially in Rwanda where it was a command, the photographers we talked to just said they couldn't. They couldn't make the picture. It was they felt just too strongly that it – I mean, partly they were unarmed and the soldiers who were committing the rapes were armed, but also they just felt it was an additional violation. So it's a complicated but a very good question and a complicated issue that photographers individually have to struggle with.
We've spoken about some photos, the difficulty of getting some kinds of images. What didn't you find that you wanted to find? I mean, scouring through all these archives all over the world, were there things that you were sort of holes that you wished you could have, you know, filled in those gaps?
Well, as a woman, I looked for photographs of rape. I asked archives about that. Of course, we were hoping to find other photographs where that moment before someone is shot in combat and did not find. We found many more execution pictures than I would like to have seen. This was not an easy exhibition to curate. But no, we were so amazed at the extraordinary photographs that had been taken in this human endeavor that we can't seem to do without. There have been no days, or maybe, I don't know, somebody claims there have been 12 days when there wasn't a war going on somewhere. But the records that have been made are extraordinary, and we just felt that for the discussion to be held, the records need to be out there.
We began the discussion on the contrast between the traditions and limitations of painters in World War I and what photography could do, but it was also censored. And one of the things that strikes me about the Rosenthal photo is it's a rare modern photo of an unabashedly heroic moment that so often war photography is either of kind of boredom, the ennui of just sitting around, the exhaustion, or, as you might say, action, explosions, people looking grim, that kind of thing, that what we used to think of a large part of war is a certain amount of heroic pageantry. And you don't often see that in this book.
Well, there are a couple of factors there. One is that since World War II, war has changed. It's so seldom a combat between two established armies who have uniforms, and it is easy to recognize the combatants on each side, starting with Nam and then the Central American wars, the African wars, the Middle Eastern wars. If there is an established army, so often they're fighting people who are in street clothes. So knowing when somebody is a combatant is terribly difficult and has led to horrendous mistakes where innocent people have been killed. It's also led to mistakes where military people have been killed because they thought somebody wasn't a combatant and they had guns or they had bombs or they had – so it's very difficult for the photographers as well as the military to anticipate when there's going to be combat. It's so changed. They're not battle lines with all one side being on one side of the battle line and the other side being on the other side. One of the categories we had in the exhibition initially was home front, and the military historian said, no, only America has a home front. In other places, it's your front door, if not your living room. Mm-hmm. And so the photographers are with the soldiers. They're on patrol. It's quiet, it's quiet, it's quiet. Bam! It's a fight. And then, you know, there's an instinct to preserve yourself by and there's a desire to make pictures. And we've had photographers who are in the exhibition who died during the course of the exhibition because they were in such situations. Tim Hetherington and Chris Hondros were tragic. I mean, all of the photographers were tragic losses, but those two were people who had such promise and had made such extraordinary photographs, but they were suddenly in the middle of a firefight. And so it's one of the things we were trying to convey is this shift. Many of us still carry in our head World War II models, and they rarely exist. And maybe, hopefully, none of us want to see two established armies fighting again like they were in World War II, but it's a much different phenomena, and we also tried to convey that in our writings.
Let's go to a caller in Dallas. Marla, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I am a photographer. I've photographed all over the world, and I'm finding this a very interesting conversation because it relates to something that I noticed several years ago. And I think it was about 2001 or 2002, the 7th Floor Museum here in Dallas had an exhibit of all the award-winning Pulitzer Prize photographs up to that point. And then I think it's probably 2001 because I think we were all trying to think what was going to be the one for that year. But what when my friends and I went through it, what we noticed was that pretty much every award-winning photograph was about war or death. And we kind of walked away saying, what does that say about society when we highlight the photographs that focus on war and death? And I don't think there were any, really, that were any positive images. I mean, they all were very moving, and there were a lot of stories behind them. You talked about some of the photographers who died taking the pictures. There was other stories about photographers who committed suicide afterwards because they were so upset about what they had seen and their inability to make a difference. So I just wonder if you have any comments on that.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Hi. Yeah, you're right. I've also served on the World Press photo juries and looking at all their photographs, the same pattern. There are a few exceptions. And I think the photograph of Kim Puck running down the road is tragic, but in that instance, he took the photograph, Nico took the photograph, and then he put his camera aside and he took her to the hospital, and they are lifelong friends. And there are some pictures of rescue in the series, but you're absolutely right that there is a voyeuristic quality to all of this that is just integrated into it, and it is a push-pull. There's a photograph of the show that's been mentioned of the Iraqi soldier burned alive in the truck, and it's a horrific photograph, but it's also an exquisitely beautiful print. And so you feel this beauty and horror all connected inside yourself. And I think that's also a component in that decision making. But that's so we did photographs of soldiers playing a piano or playing cards. There are quite a number of photographs of soldiers playing cards because and listening to music, because we did want to show that there are other components to life in the military.
You're saying that the war photography gets the attention, gets the awards, partly because of the very strong emotions it evokes. I also wonder if it's because that effort, it's some of the riskiest things you can do as a photographer. So all that effort, all that difficulty in capturing those images.
I'm not sure the general public thinks about that. I think when people look at a photograph, they are connecting their own experiences, their own fears, their own questions about themselves, what they would do. I think a lot of people don't understand the risks the photographers are taking. There's one photograph. There's three photographs in the show that were actually re-visualized in Ben Affleck's film on Iran. And one of them is the pulling out of a military general, the Shah's general, by a mob who then lynched him. And looking at that picture, the only place the photographer can be is on the hood of the car. And I think about him being on the hood of the car photographing when there are hundreds of violently angry Iranians, and this was a French photographer, Patrick Chevelle, what's he thinking? But I don't think the public thinks about the danger. I hope they will, because these photographers have taken great risk. And just like the veterans, many, many of these photographers have PTSD.
Really?
Oh, yeah. How can they not? They've seen the same things. They've experienced the same horrors. So, I mean, none of us could sleep well by the end of this project. And we weren't even there. We were just, vicariously experiencing it. It's taken all three of us a while to get back away from the difficulty of this project.
Our guest today has been Anne Wilkes Tucker, whose book, War/Photography. She will be talking at the Collin County Community College next month, October 20th. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and Lindsay Knecht. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. We had help on the phones today from Addie Sun, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Jerome Weeks in for Chris Boyd. Thanks, Anne. And thanks for listening, and have a great day.